This is the last week, as far as I know, on this series. And I say that because it could be I'll come back and preach an epilogue sermon next week. But right now, I think I'm done. We're done with the book of Job as of today. We're going to get all the way to the end of the book of Job today. We've been on a journey, and we've been talking about why bad things happen to good people. And in fact, we've been talking about why bad things happen to righteous people. And we're using the book of Job as the lens for that. We're on week number 5, and this is when finally God gets to speak. This is remarkable. I call it my early morning meditation. This is the time after my alarm goes off, but before I get out of bed. I call that my early morning meditation. So I'm in my early morning meditation and kind of praying. I'm thinking about this series, and I'm thinking about everything. And it occurred to me that in the Old Testament, this, what I'm about to show you, is the longest section that God speaks. Now, God speaks through prophets and through the, you know, psalmist and things like that, but God actually showing up from his mouth and speaking, this is it. This is the longest section in the entire Old Testament. Jesus, you know, he'll come and he'll preach, and that's probably the longest in, you know, Sermon on the Mount. But this is the longest recorded section that the Creator God speaks. That's kind of significant. Beyond that, this is, according to most theologians, the first book of the Bible, as in the first book that was written in the Bible. You actually find it right before Psalms, but it was probably the oldest book of the Bible. And they say that because some of the text and thing is really ancient Hebrew. It's like, you know, if we went to King James and then went back 100 years from there, that's like what it'd be. And so it's ancient Hebrew. And even in Moses' day, they didn't use some of these terms. So they believe it was actually the very first book written. No one knows who wrote it. People suspect Moses wrote it down, but people also suspect it existed before he was alive. They believe that Job probably lived before Abraham and maybe even before Noah. We're not really sure. Because there's a lot of things that never happen in the book of Job. You know, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are never mentioned. The law is never mentioned. There's a lot of things that never mentioned. So this obviously took place before all of that. And so it's a very interesting story from that regard. But I want to think about that for a second, because the High King of Heaven, the first time he decided to inspire somebody with something that happened so that it would be remembered, is the book of Job. And I don't know about you, but I thought, wow, this is like his first. This is like, you know, the first book's always the most important. And ask any writer, they'll tell you the first book they write was the one that really meant something to them. This really means something to God. It was his first book. And so I was thinking, you know, why do Christians continually ignore it? And I'll put my hand up with that. I mean, I just like, you know, if I'm going through the Bible, I skip over the book of Job because I know it's in there and I don't want to see it. I just don't want to deal with it. I don't want to think about it. But this was God's first. And so then I was thinking about that, and I was actually kind of lying in bed, and it was kind of a prayer. I said, God, why in the world, if this book is so important to you, did you make it a poem? I mean, nothing against poetry, okay? But it's a poem, and poetry is like doesn't seem to have the same gravitas as, you know, like the Proverbs or something. You know, why do we make this a poem? And I didn't expect an answer, but I kind of got one. Instantly, this came into my mind, because poems are easier to memorize. I mean, I don't know about you, but like if I asked you, hey, tell me a story from your teenage years or something, some of you that's like, you know, yesterday. But, you know, for those of us who are older, that's a long time ago, right? And tell me a favorite story. You could like remember maybe a story and you get some of those details wrong. But if I said, hey, recite to me the lyrics of your favorite song that you knew in high school. Oh man, we can nail it. You know, some of the songs we shouldn't have been listening to in high school, but we still remember those lyrics, don't we? Well, that's because memorization is easier when things are poetry. And so God created this, and this was a time before a lot of people had written language at all, and certainly this is a time before Xerox machines and printing presses. And so in order to have a book, people had to scribe it down. Well, that's a hard way to try to get it to the people. But boy, if you can memorize it, and it could be told from father to son and from generation to generation, not only does it get spread, it stays the same. It doesn't change. And so it's really interesting to me that God took this care for this story, and I believe it's because he has something really important to tell us in the book of Job, and we are missing it because we're afraid of getting into the detail with God sometimes. We want to kind of keep this idea up here. We don't want to get all the way down, you know, where the rubber meets the road and tragedy happens. So anyway, this is the moment that everybody's been waiting for in the book of Job. You know, for several chapters now, we talked about this last week, Job and his friends were discussing theology. And they all, you know, kind of went through the same sort of a cycle. And one thing that kind of came up again and again is Job would say, you know what, if God were just here, I would speak to him. If I would love to plead my case before the Lord. I would love to do that. Well, be careful what you wish for, because sometimes God shows up. Remember that scene from Forrest Gump?
No shrimp.
Where the hell's this God of yours?
It's funny Lieutenant Dan said that, because right then, God showed up.
Now, be careful when you ask for God. Sometimes he shows up. And he shows up in Job exactly the same way he shows up there. The modern translation is called a whirlwind, but the older translation is called a hurricane or a tornado. It was a gale wind force God shows up in, and he starts speaking to them. So you can imagine God was shouting. And the other thing is, you're going to notice that in this text, God's a little bit peeved. In fact, he's a little bit, I'm just going to say it, sarcastic. He's been listening to this discourse going on now for 7 days, and he's had it. And so he sets up, and he shows up to set the record straight. We have to realize that. He's here to set the record straight. Now, what they've been arguing about is why this bad thing is happening to Job. That's the big debate. Why is this happening? And, why is this happening? And his three friends' theory is, you're really an evil man, Job, and you've hidden it from us, but you have not hidden it from God. And he's getting you. And if you would just confess your sin, you'd be okay, because we know this to be true. All the righteous are blessed, and all the guilty are punished. And that's a truism, and since it has to be true, and you're being not blessed, but rather punished, it must be sin in your life. And Job is saying, no, I'm telling you, I'm the same man now when all this has happened to me that I was, 3 months ago when I was blessed, higher than anybody. And so this whole thing is this debate. Why is this happening? Now, God's going to show up, and here's what's interesting. He's not going to answer any of their questions. and I'm just warning you now, spoiler alert, we never get the answer to why me. In fact, God doesn't even recognize the question. What God does is completely different, and I think it is instructive, because what he does when he shows up is he basically tells us, you have no idea what you're asking me. I can't answer the question you're asking, because it's not even the right question. There are questions before we can get to that question, and you can't even comprehend those, so let's just stop this debate right now. So God shows up, and he answers Job out of the whirlwind and says, who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? That'd be Job, by the way, is who he's really talking to here. He says, now, gird up your loins like a man, I love that phrase, and I will ask you, and you will instruct me. This is sarcastic, right? You're going to instruct me, not Job. Let me explain, gird your loins up like a man. There was a thing that the warriors had put on before they went to battle called a girdle. And, men don't wear girdles anymore, but we know what a kind of a girdle is and where it fits. Well, the purpose of that was, first of all, it protected a very important part of a man. Let's just go ahead and say that. But the other thing about the girdle was all the armor fastened to it. It was at the centerpiece of the entire army, and you had to do that because that's where the center of gravity is. So everything buckled down onto the girdle that would go around the loins, and that's where the armor came, and that's where the sword went, and all that. So everything went there. So what God's saying is, get ready for battle, Job. I need you to get ready for battle here. Get ready, because we're going to talk about some things. Not the questions you asked me. I'm going to ask some questions now. So before I get to your questions, and I'll answer your questions, but first you have to answer mine. And so he breaks this down to three parts, or we break it down to three parts. And the first one I'm going to call the cosmos. So he starts laying out, and this is very, very interesting, because what God describes here in Job is something we all know. He's going to describe a world that we understand. You have to understand, that's not the world Job knew. This is what was really interesting. Remember, until 1492, we believed the earth was flat, and that the earth was the center of the universe and the sun revolved around it. Remember that? We got people thrown out of the church because they tried to say that wasn't true. Okay, so imagine what they believed back in Job's day. And so God's going to come up, and he's going to start describing things, and he's going to describe things that we take for granted today, but in those days were not known. So he starts by saying this. He says, were you there when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me, if you have understanding, who set its measurements? Who decided how big the planet Earth was? Since you know. Who stretched the line on it? On what were the bases sunk? How is the Earth hung inside of our universe? Who enclosed the sea with doors when bursting forth it went out from the womb? I placed boundaries on it. I set a bolt and doors. I said, thus far you shall come, but no farther. And here your proud waves will stop. Who did that exactly, Job? Do you know? And what he's actually describing, and I've ever been in the sea and seen it at night when the sea starts rising and the tides start coming in. He's saying, you know, it could have swarmed over the whole earth, but I stopped it. I said, this far you come, and then it stops. And, you know, there's always a high water mark. If you've ever been to the ocean, you know there's this high water mark. God said, I set that high water mark so that you would have land that you can live on. Do you know how I did that? Do you have any idea? Have you ever in your life commanded the morning? Does the sun rise on your command, Job? And cause the dawn to know its place, that it might take hold of the ends of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it. And this is something else God's doing here. He's actually giving us, he's describing the earth, but he's also paralleling it with life. Because what he's saying is, you know how important light is? When light's there, wickedness runs. You notice that? There's not nearly as much of the crime in the daytime as there is at night because people can hide around the shadows. He says, I'm bringing it out so the wicked are shaken off the earth. That's why the earth, that's why the light comes up. Did you do that, Job? Do you understand how that's done? Have you ever done that? How about this? Where is the dwelling of light? Where does the sun go? Where's the sun go, Job? Do you have any idea? Or darkness, where's its place? How is it light and darkness? Where does darkness go when light's up? Where does light go when darkness is up? Have you entered the storehouses of snow? I love this next one. Have you seen the storehouses of hail, which I have reserved for the time of distress and for the day of war and battle? Wait a minute. Hail's a weapon? Well, it is to God. He's like, I've stored up hail in heaven specifically for a battle. It's like, well, that's really kind of weird. Really? Because we've seen it in the Bible. It happens in Exodus. He says to Moses, stretch out your hand toward the sky. And Moses did. And the Lord sent thunder and hail. And of course, since it's God, and fire, to rain down on the earth. There was hail and fire flashing continually in the midst of the hail, very severe, such as had not been seen in all the land of Egypt since it became a nation. Hey, you do not mess with the one who has hail stored up in heaven ready to throw down. All right? So he said, I've done that, Job. Do you know where I keep it? Do you have any idea where I keep the hail that I'm ready to throw down, you know, if I need to? Or how about this? Can you bind the chains of Pleiades or loose the cords of Orion? Can you lead forth a constellation in its season and guide the bear with her satellites? Do you know the ordinances of the heavens or fix their rule over the earth? Now, what he's talking about here, from those of you who kind of picked up on it, is the stars. And this is, by the way, really important because this is how sailors navigate it. I actually took a sailing class when I was in Texas, and they taught us how to navigate by the stars. You can do it. You honestly can do it. That's how they did it. So this is Orion, and this is Orion's belt. It's very important. And then you have the Big and Little Bear, also called the Big and Little Dipper. And that's a really, really important constellation because that points to something known as the North Star. And you have to be able to find the North Star. And what God's saying is, do you know anything about this, Job? Do you know how I put them in the orbit, the way I put them in the orbit, so you can do what you're doing? Do you understand that because they're ordered, you have order in your life so you can actually plan your sea ventures and you can look and know where north is? Do you understand that I did that? Doesn't have to be that way. They could come up in a different place every day. Nope, I've made them come up the same place every day. Do you know how I did that? Do you have any idea how I lead the constellations across your sky? Do you have any idea at all? And Job is really starting to get an idea that God is describing things which he hasn't even understood. And Job's not unique in this because we have a tendency to be very self-focused when we have our problems. God, why aren't you listening to me and my problems? Why is my world not your world? We have a tendency to kind of be focused like that. And God's saying, Job, the world's much bigger than you can possibly imagine. And so he goes from the cosmos to what I'm going to call the living earth. He's going to start talking about things that Job takes for granted. We all take for granted how the animal kingdom works. He says, listen, do you hunt the prey for the lion? Can you do that? Can you make sure the lions are fed? The ones out there, can you make sure they're fed? No. How about satisfying the appetite of their young lions? You ever thought of that? And then they crouch in their dens and they lie in wait in their lair, but who brings the food by? They can't go to the supermarket. Who brings their food by? Who prepares the raven its nourishment when it's young, cry to God, and wander about without food? He says, you understand I hear every cry for hunger. I hear it from you. I hear it from the lions. I hear it from the ravens. I hear them all. You know, Jesus tells us that one sparrow does not drop to the ground that the Lord does not know about. He says, I'm watching everything here. all of it. He said, do you know the time the mountain goats give birth? Have you ever Googled? I should have put this picture in there. Google mountain goats. This is insane what those people do. They're like on the side of cliffs, these little animals. I can't imagine them giving birth there. Do you observe the calving of the deer? Can you count the months they fulfill, or do you know the time they give birth? Do you have any idea on that, Job? The deer and the goats, do you understand how that all works? No, I never really paid attention. You guys hunt them, but do you ever really pay attention to them? Their offspring become strong. They grow up in the open field, and they leave and do not return. Do you ever notice that? Ever notice how they migrate? Have you ever noticed the same deer this year, the same deer from last year, because they migrate? Have you paid attention to that, Job? And then he goes on. Do you give the horse his might? This is interesting because he starts talking about animals that they know a lot about. But he's saying, look, I created the horse for you. I created it for you. And I gave it to you. And I worked out some details about the horse that you've probably never considered. Did you close the neck with the mane? Do you know why there's a mane on a horse, Job? Any idea? No? Okay. He paws the valley and rejoices in his strength. He goes out to meet weapons. And this is true about horses. They're courageous. Man, the people have been talking about this for thousands of years. He laughs at fear. He's not dismayed. With shaking and rage, he races over the ground. I love this image of a war horse running into battle, right? And he does not stand still at the voice of the trumpet. As often as the trumpet sounds, he says, aha. He's ready to go. He is ready to go to battle. Do you understand that I gave you a horse that's not afraid of anything? And people tell you this. You can literally run a horse to death. It's easy to do because horses just want to go. He says, I put some things in them that you need in order to do this. Did you ever consider all the facets of just a horse that you probably rode to get here? All the things I put in it to make that possible. Is it by your understanding that the hawk soars? You have any idea how they do that? Catching the wind thermals and flying up? You have any idea? Stretching his wings toward the south. Is it at your command that the eagle mounts up and make its nest on high? Why does the eagle sleep up there? Do you know, Job? Do you have any idea? Job, how are we doing so far? I have asked you some questions. You have some for me, but before I ask them, I'll answer those. But how are you doing with these questions? Because I'm trying to give you an idea of the enormity of the world you live in. Because you seem to think it's all here. And I'm trying to tell you it's all there. And I see it all. And then the Lord says, will the fault finder, that's you, Job, contend with the Almighty? Are you really want to do this? Okay, let him who reproves God answer these questions. Here's the deal, Job. If you can answer me these questions, I will stand trial and I will listen to all your charges. I'm ready. Go ahead. Answer away, Job. Give me anything. Go ahead. Answer. And Job answers the Lord and says this, behold, I am insignificant. What can I reply to you? I lay my hand on my mouth. Once I've spoken and I will not answer. In other words, I said it once. I'm not doing this again. Even twice and I will add nothing more. He's saying, look, I said this once and now I see it's useless. If I said it again, it would make nothing, no bit of difference. I am not about to question him. Look, you cannot have a trial if someone's declared incompetent. We know this. If you have, you know, defendant or prosecutor, and they come in and once declared crazy or incompetent, not fit to stand trial, the trial's over. And that's basically what's happened here. God says, you're not capable of having, you've said you want to have me in trial, you want to present your case, you're not capable of presenting your case because you have no idea what's going on. Now, keep in mind that what's going on, we know, is that Satan is involved in this. This is interesting too. God never mentions Satan. It would be really, really easy at this point for God to say, by the way, I didn't do this to you. Some guy named Satan did. But we see nothing in the theology of Job or his friends that indicate they even know the demon world exists. They kind of know about angels, but they have no clue about the demon world and the battle that's raging. They have no clue at all. And I really believe that the reason God does not sit down and tell him is because it would just be too hard to explain to him at this point. He just wants to get him the idea of two things. One is there's a big, big world out there. And number two is God is still in charge. And so he's just trying to get him to understand that. And so the other thing that you'll never see him say is, well, you deserve this, Job. He never says, well, I did this to work something out in your character. Here's God Almighty right here to answer the question we all want him to answer. Why do bad things happen to good people? And he doesn't even address it. But he certainly does not say, well, because I'm working something out in your life. This is all my plan. He doesn't say that because it's not true. He also doesn't say this is sin in your life that brought this on you because it's not true. And so a lot of the pat answers that Christianity has for this question, God skips right over because they aren't true. And I believe that's the biggest purpose for the book of Job, because we get our theology all twisted. We want it to be about righteousness, because then we can control chaos. If all I have to do is be righteous and nothing bad will ever happen to me, then that's in my control. I may not be good at being righteous, but I know how to, you know, I have the rule book, I could do that. And if something bad happens to me, it's because I'm not righteous. Well, I can stop doing that and fix the bad thing. We want to be in control. What God's saying is, you are not. There are forces at work here greater than you can even comprehend. And so it's not that simple, Job. And now God goes into third phase. And this one's interesting. This is the monster phase. And I'm going to tell you, it's just really, and some people, everybody kind of wants to explain things for God. I think God knows exactly what he's saying here. Some people want to say, well, he's kind of talking about it mythologically, or this is kind of symbolically. And this is not it at all, because he is talking about creatures that lived in Job's time. And he's talking about them as though Job knows what he's talking about. And Job doesn't say, excuse me, God, I don't know what that is. He knows what he's talking about. So, you know, this may be a scary part, kind of, you know, going off the map here a little bit for some of us, but it's in the book of Job, and I believe it is true.
You're off the edge of the map, mate. Here there be monsters.
Just fair warning, because there's no two ways about it. Here there be monsters, because now he goes in, he says, the Lord answered Job again, saying, now repair yourself like a man, and I will ask you, and you will instruct me. Same thing he said before. Will you really question my judgment? So you really want to know? I've given you the easy stuff. I'm going to give you something harder now. Okay? You're not going to condemn me that you can be justified, because that's what Job did. Right? He basically said, it can't be me, I'm righteous. Therefore, God, he actually said, this must have invented crimes against me so he could punish me. He says, no, you're not going to condemn me to justify yourself. It's okay, he said, he was righteous because he was, but don't tell me now. You know, don't blame me now for what's happening here. You're not going to do that. And so he's being very specific with this. And he says, you're not going to do that. You don't have an arm like God, and you can't thunder with a voice like mine. And before we get into the monsters, he tells him one thing. He says, here's the thing. Go ahead. If you can adorn yourself with eminence and dignity, clothe yourself with honor and majesty, look on everyone who is proud and humble him, tread down the wicked where they stand, hide them in the dust together, bind them in hidden places, then I will say to you that your right hand can save you. If you can do what I can do, then you know what? You can save you by your own actions. But you can't. And I believe that's a really important lesson for us, because there's nothing you can do about this, is what he's saying. Your strength, your might, your righteousness will not protect you. The only one who can protect you is me. And then he starts laying out the case here for these monsters, and I believe the reason he's focusing on the monsters is because he's hinting to the demonic world. He's not talking about the demonic world, but I think he's trying to give Job an understanding that there are powers much greater than he can comprehend that are going on in this world. And he starts with something called the behemoth. He said, behold now the behemoth, which I made as well as you. He eats grass like an ox. Now I was taught this was kind of a big sort of hippopotamus or like a big cow or something. But watch God's descriptions. Behold now his strength and power. Cow's starting to fall away, right? He bends his tail like a cedar. Have you ever seen a cow's tail? You know, that's not a cedar, is it? Have you seen a cedar? These huge things that stick up in the air, and they're very strong. When the wind blows, they swing back, you know? He said, this is what his tail's like a cedar tree. The sinews of his thighs are knit together. His bones are tubes of bronze, and his limbs are like bars of iron. That doesn't sound like anything that we have in our zoos or our farms. You know what this sounds like? It sounds like a dinosaur. And the interesting thing is, you know, when I started looking at that, well, that sounds just like a dinosaur. And I started researching it, and a lot of people think that's exactly what God's describing. He's describing a big, large dinosaur. And well, we have a problem with that, right? Because we're taught that dinosaurs, if they lived at all, lived, you know, millions of years before we came along. And they all died before we got here because some meteor hit the Earth and caused the ice age. Very quietly, if you Google this, you'll find out there's a lot of scientists that say that's all bunk. They don't say dinosaurs didn't exist, but they say the theory of the meteor causing an ice age is off its rocker. It just gets held on to because it's so easy to explain to kids in school. But there's a lot of facts they've discovered that throw all that out the window, not least of which is the crater that supposedly shows this doesn't show that at all. It does, you know, as they've gotten deeper into the science of it, they say, you know, this couldn't have been that. But beyond that, even the dinosaurs that we know about, the herbivores, according to the way evolution presents things, they couldn't have gotten the grass they were eating because it hadn't existed yet. Right? So there's all kind of problems with this theory of the dinosaurs living, you know, this early, you know, rugged world, and then somehow they died off in an ice age. Also, where all the fossils are found at the same basic time, it doesn't match with where they would find them if there was this big ice age. In fact, many people believe that dinosaurs, or at least some of them, were living on Earth when man was here. And it surely seems like this is exactly, in fact, there are some people, by the way, who believe the dinosaurs were on the boat with Noah or trailing behind him in the water. Anyway, so it certainly seems like Job knows what a behemoth is anyway. And God's talking to him like he knows what it is. And he goes on, and this is interesting. He says this, he is, talking about behemoth, the first of the ways of God. I wonder if that's saying I created them kind of in the early part. Remember the creation story? He creates all the animals. Yeah, I created him first. He's one of the first animals I created, right? But let his maker bring near his sword. In other words, I'll take care of this, not you. The mountains bring him food, and all the beasts of the field play there. If a river rages, he's not alarmed. He's confident. Though the Jordan rushes to his mouth, he's fine. He's big, he's strong. The river doesn't bother this guy. Can anyone capture him when he's on watch with barbs that could pierce his nose? They could take big animals, they could put these rings through them and lead them around by the rings, but no one's done to the behemoth. Now, the behemoth that God's describing is a plant eater. It's a herbivore, and it's kind of gentle, but just that big, it's going to destroy things just wandering through, you know, typical bull in a china shop kind of a thing. And that tail swings by, and if a behemoth came through a village, it would have just wiped it out, not meaning to or anything. He's just looking for his next meal, but he's like, you know, boom, 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 and there's nothing you can do about it. And Job is not arguing with him because he understands that is one of these chaotic things that no one can control, and when it hits, it destroys. And there's nothing they can do about it. But then God shifts gears to another monster, something called Leviathan. Now, this has been kind of made famous these days because of the Pirates of the Caribbean movies. But the Leviathan's been around, you know, since the time of Job. And the idea of the Leviathan, again, you look at how God describes it. He's not talking about a mythological creature. He's talking about something Job would have known. He says, can you draw out the Leviathan with a fish hook? Ever try to do that? You know, I've seen this big sea monster. It's kind of funny. Do you press down his tongue with a cord? That's something they can do with crocodiles. They can do that. They can bind the tongue down. Not the Leviathan. Can you put a rope in his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? You know, if you lay your hand on him after the battle, you won't do it again. No one touches one of those things and remembers it again. Behold, your expectation is false because no one is so fierce that he dares to arouse him. So who then is he who can stand before me? Because I made him, and he answers to me. He says, the biggest, baddest, most wicked thing you could imagine, I can control. And you're going to stand before me and judge me? Who exactly is going to stand before me and judge me? His sneezes flash forth light. His eyes are like the eyelids of the morning. Out of his mouth go burning torches. Sparks of fire leap forth. It's like a fire-breathing dragon. And by the way, there are some fossils and things that have been found by some creatures they actually believe that had some kind of capability to basically expel phosphorus sort of things. Like the electric eel can generate electric charge. They believe one of these things they've discovered, which would have been a sea-bearing monster, had that kind of capability. So out of his nostrils goes forth smoke as from a boiling pot and burning rushes. His breath kindles coals and flame goes forth from his mouth. His neck lodges strength. Dismay leaps before him. The folds of his flesh are joined together, firm on him and immovable. This is scales, right? He's like, where's armor? His heart is as hard as stone. The sword that reaches him cannot avail, nor the spear, or the dart, or the javelin. He regards iron as straw and bronze as rotten wood. The arrow cannot make him flee. Now this is a terror, because this thing, when it comes up, it attacks. You know, clearly, this thing has laced entire port cities. And you know, the Bible's not the only thing that talks about these. You know, these have been around for a long time. Ever wonder why? Like every civilization has talked about this. It's because it must have existed once upon a time. Nothing on earth is like him. He's without fear. He looks on everything that is high. He is king over all the sons of pride, all of you, he's saying. No one is so fierce that he dares to arouse him. Who then is he that can stand before me? Because I can tame him. And I believe that God is saying there is chaos that you don't even know, that's setting forth to destroy you, and I am holding it at bay. And you're going to question me about the job that I'm doing. You're going to tell me I'm not doing a good enough job. Do you know everything that I'm doing for you? Do you know everything I've done just to put in the world in place? But I've also kept chaos at bay for you. And you're going to challenge me now because of 7 days of an ailment. Now, look, I don't mean to make light of Job's illness. I would not want to go through what he went through, either phase of his life. But people believe that Job was 70 years old when this happened. He has known God his entire adult life. It wasn't just that he was righteous. He had a relationship with the living God. When God, think about this, when God came and spoke to him, he didn't freak out. I believe he's heard the voice of God before. He had a relationship with the living God. He loved God, and God loved him. That's why he built the hedge around him. He just loved Job. He was righteous, and they had this relationship. That's what righteousness means, right standing with God. For 70 years, 70 years, they had this incredible relationship, and he blessed Job's socks off. He's been sick for 7 days. I'm out. I've had it, God. I'm out of this. God must be like, what about the 70 years before? Don't I get any kind of credit for that? Just like seven bad days, and suddenly I'm a bad God? He says, do you have any idea what I have done just to keep the earth going? And this is something that I think that we don't fully get, is the chaos that threatens to overwhelm us, that God keeps at bay. And Job answers the Lord and says, you know, I know you can do all things. I know no purpose of yours is thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge, you asked? Well, I have declared that which I did not understand. Things just too incomprehensible for me, which I did not understand. You said, hear now, and I will speak and ask, and you will instruct me. Well, I've heard. I've heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eyes see you as well, and therefore I retract everything, and I repent in dust and ashes. I believe what he's actually saying is, I hear you, but I not only hear you, I see the world you're describing. And I realize I don't have any idea. I don't have any right to question you. And I'm backing off. I retract. In fact, not only do I say I'm retracting, I'm repenting. I'm telling you I should have never done it. So now God turns his attention to the others. And he turns to Eliphaz, and he must have been like the head of the three that were sitting there for 7 days telling Job, well, this is clearly sinful because God always punishes sinful people and you're being punished, right? So they're speaking for God. Be careful speaking for God. There's some scripture in the Bible that scares me to death that talks about how teachers of the word are going to be held to a higher standard. And I'm telling you what, I thought that one meant a lot before I decided to become a teacher of the word. And some of these churches that are out there, you know, claiming they speak for God, I would not want to be the Westboro Baptist Church in the Day of Judgment because they sure think they speak for God. Anyway, but he says, so he turns to them and he says, my wrath is kindled against you and against your two friends. He leaves the young kid out of it because the young kid kind of had it right. But because you have not spoken of me what is right, you don't speak for me. You're telling people things about me that just aren't true and has made me angry. You weren't like my servant Job. Now, therefore, take yourself 7 bulls and 7 rams, and you think, okay, now he's going to tell him to sacrifice to him. No, he's not. And go to my servant Job. You're going to go to Job. And you're going to have Job offer up a sacrifice for yourselves. And if my servant Job prays for you, I'll accept him. I am so angry with you, I will not accept your prayers. I will not restore you. I will smite you. I'm going to wipe you out from the face of the earth. Unless Job decides to pray on your behalf. Him I'll listen to. Don't you know that about that time those guys wish they'd been a lot nicer to Job for the 7 days that went before this? Oh, you know, Job, just kidding, man. We know you're righteous. But, you know, this is like the very first high priest of the high king God. You know, it's like he has now put Job in a position where he's going to stand in the gap between sinners and God. Because he said, I'll listen to Job. But I'm not going to listen to you. And by the way, he doesn't tell Job to do it. He says, take it to him, and if he prays, then I'll restore you. Otherwise, I'm killing you. Up to Job. And Job, by the way, has not been healed at this point. He's still covered in boils. And God's saying, you're called, Job. What are you going to do? Now, Job is righteous, and he's looking for a way to get back in righteous standing with God, and he's ready to go to the next level with God. And so he does it. And this is interesting. After he does it, the Lord restores the fortunes of Job when he prayed for his friends. That's when God heals him and restores him. Now, we don't know if he would have anyway. But he says, you know, are you ready to take the next step in righteousness, Job? Understand, this is not why he brought this. There's nothing in the Bible that even hints that this is why God brought it, like Job wasn't righteous. None of that. He's saying, you've been righteous. You ready to go to the next level? Because I'm going to take you to a level you can't believe. Because it's a level that's barely reached in the entire Bible. In fact, I wondered when I was sitting there thinking that, boy, I wish I had the prayer Job prayed for his friends. I wonder if it sounded something like this. Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. Because we won't see righteousness like this again until the hand from the cross has reached out. Bloody, like Job's hand would have been bloody. Saying, forgive them. Father, forgive them. So then the Lord increases everything Job had twofold. Doubles it up. Everything he had, he brings back and plus another. A whole second heaping helping here. And all of this, all of his brothers and sisters, all who had known him before, came to him. No one was there when he lost everything. Hey, can we help you out, Job? No one was there when he was sick. Can we take care of you, Job? They're all sitting up there, whoa, Job's really having a bad time over there. But as soon as they hear everything got restored, oh, everybody shows back up. And they all eat bread with him, and they all come to his house for a big party. But I want you to catch the irony of the next line of the Bible. Because if you don't understand that God has just basically told those three with their stupid theology, they're all wrong. He was so angry he's going to destroy them. And that he is basically just telling Job, there's chaos in the world and I'm helping you and I love you and I've never taken my eye off of you. That's what's happened. But watch what happens next. Those people console him and comfort him for all the evil distress and misery that the Lord had brought upon him. He didn't bring anything on him. So it's almost like the Bible's like, some people just are never going to get it, you know? Job understands, I think those three friends understand, but everybody else who wasn't there for all this, they just don't get it. They still think that God brings evil upon people. It's like, what are you going to do? All those relatives, it's almost a funny aside to me. It's like the Bible's like, hey, you won't believe it, no one got it but Job. And then the Lord blesses him. The latter days of his life were more blessed than the first. He had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, 1,000 female donkeys. I have no idea if that's a lot, but it sounds like a lot to me. Right? He had 7 sons and 3 daughters, so he brings back more children. And by the way, his previous children kind of putzes. I think Job didn't mind having a do-over on that. And so they were this new batch of kids he gets are just much better than the first batch. In all the land, no women were found so fair as Job's daughters. So beautiful daughters, you know, in his old age. He gets to raise them up. But watch this. This is very, very interesting. Their father gave them inheritance among the brothers. This was simply not done back then. Women were like chattel. They were belongings. They weren't allowed to own things. If you remember the story of Ruth and Naomi, they weren't allowed to own things. They had to have a man own things, but not Job. Job says, I'm giving my daughters inheritances. And in fact, he puts it amongst his sons. So it's like, you can't even get to their land unless you come through the boys. Sons, you know, he says, you know, take care of your sisters. So he puts their inheritance right in there. So here's the setup. They're beautiful and they're rich. They must have had a line of suitors to choose from. They probably came from all over. You know, there's the brothers. You don't get to our sisters unless you go through us. Right? And Job lived 140 years after this. That's why they think he was 70 when all this happened. And there's a reason why people lived longer back then. And he saw his sons and grandsons for 4 generations. And Job died an old man and full of days. So it's really a great story the way it ends. But I got to tell you, it doesn't always end there like that. In the book of Job, it does. But sometimes for us, it doesn't. And what we have to understand is that God isn't telling us that all of your days are going to, you know, end like Job's. If you're only looking at this world, you're just not going to find the end that you want. Because God has told us in his teachings that this world isn't all there is. In fact, he says this world's a very small part of what is. You need to take everything in consideration to understand what God is doing. But before I get to that, I want to stop on this for 1 second because this is what I believe the Bible is teaching us here. And this is a belief. You know, I've told you, I'm going to try to be honest about that. I can't point to scripture on this. But I believe God's saying there is chaos in the world, and sometimes it's going to get you. And I'm holding it at bay, but there is chaos. And it wasn't by design, but it's the way things are. We talked a couple weeks ago about in the sermon on the devil's purpose about how God gave us choice because he wanted to give us the choice to love him. That's the only way you can really be in love with somebody. You have to have a choice. So he gave us that choice. But at the same time, he also gave the choice for us to do evil, which we did. And we ruined everything. The world we see is not the world God created. It went from a perfect world to a chaotic world where evil's everywhere. Decay, death, cancer. These things weren't in the original world. They're in our world because of sin. And all of a sudden, we have a world that's spiraling out. And it could get really bad really fast. Second law of thermonuclear dynamics and entropy, if you want to get into the study of that. But most places get worse, 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 and gets destroyed. God's holding this from happening in our world. He's keeping chaos at bay to give everybody a chance to choose. Now, I don't know how long he's going to do that. I don't know what, you know, how he's counting up the years, or I don't know. But he's holding it so we all have choices. We all have the choice to choose him or not. He's holding chaos at bay for us. But we have to understand, because of the world we live in, bad things will happen to good people. Not because God planned it. It's just that God's so good at making good things out of bad things, it seems like it. But it's not because he plans it. It's because we're on a battle zone between good and evil. And in battle zones, sometimes the innocent suffer. Ask any soldier. And I believe that the story of Job is basically the story that that happens. And when he's talking about the monsters that come, that happens. Doesn't mean I don't love you, but it does happen. If you took a very simple ecosystem, let me explain why I think this works. And this is a very simple little ecosystem. Let's take my bed. And this isn't that kind of a sermon. This is about sleeping in bed. Okay, so my bed is shared by two people. And we have a queen-size bed, and every night when we go to sleep, each of us gets 50% of the bed, okay? We have an ecosystem here, right? We love each other. We care about each other. You stop caring when you're asleep, though, right? So there are things going on in our little ecosystem of the bed. One of them is blankets, okay? Now, I like my blankets loose. I like to know I can stick my foot out of the blanket any time. My wife's version of sleeping is similar to the boa weevil in an Egyptian carpet, right? I mean, it's just like she burrows down and that's all fine when the night starts. But at some point in the night, she turns that way and I turn this way and all the covers go with her, right? And suddenly, I'm way too free in bed. And it takes a while usually for the chill to set in and I'm like, oh man, that's a little cold, you know? Okay, now imagine at that moment I say, God, I need a miracle. I need you to change the heart and style of my wife sleeping, because she's asleep. I can't talk to her. Could you please make her give up the covers? You know. But if he did that, he would be taking away her choice, right? But she chose to sleep that way. She wants to sleep that way. I know, but I'm cold, Lord. You know. But I can't take away the choice from her. That's her choice. Okay, then could you make the blanket bigger? How about that? Just cover me with a blanket. Can't do that either. Do you know how big that blanket will be tomorrow? How are you going to put it back on the bed, right? So there's this very simple little choice and a very simple little ecosystem makes a difference, doesn't it? And this is the kind of thing that happens all the time. In other words, what I'm telling you is, we assume that because God can do anything, he could step in our lives and make a miracle happen. And it would have no impact on the rest of the world. What if that's not true? What if a miracle here impacts something happening over there? We don't have any idea of the complexity of the chaos that God's managing. In a world where he's trying to give everybody free choice, but still control things so the good people don't suffer, there's a balancing act. And I'm just saying that sometimes I believe that things happen that way because if I step in here, it's going to have ramifications you can't possibly understand. Because it seems to me what God's saying to Job is, you don't get it, and I can't explain it. I cannot explain to you how complex the world is. I just can't. But here's what I can tell you. Here's what I can tell you. There's more to it than this. Because I'm a God who creates order out of chaos. And it's my plan to do it again. That's how our world got created. He took total chaos and created order. We brought chaos back. He says, I'm going to fix that. And Paul talks about this in Philippians. He says, look, brethren, I don't think I've obtained all this. I don't think I'm it. I'm not the big it here. I'm not. But this I know. And this one thing I do, forgetting what lies behind, reaching forward always to what lies ahead, I press on. That's what God wants us to do. Press on toward the goal, for the prize, through the upward call of God in Christ Jesus. Press on always to the prize. Always just press on. And the reason we continually press on like that is because there's another day coming. There's a day coming when finally God's going to bring order back in, but not to this world. This one's done. He's going to recreate the world that he created to begin with. And this time he's going to put people who chose him instead of evil. And he's going to bring us back together in a world that will never be corrupted. And there's a vision we have of this in the book of Revelation, another book people skip. In the book of Revelation, when the apostle John, last living apostle, sees his vision of what it's going to be like. And this is really, really cool. I want you to catch this because he describes it and then God tells him something. He says this, he says, I saw a new heaven and a new earth. The first heaven and the first earth, they passed away. I saw the new Jerusalem coming down out of heaven from God. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the tabernacle of God is among men. This is a big deal because the tabernacle is where God dwells. He says, I'm with you again. We're back. The way it was supposed to be at the beginning, the way it was with Adam and Eve before things got screwed up. I am with you. I'm here. You're not alone wondering where I am. I am right here with you. And he will dwell among them, and they shall be his people, and God himself will be among them. And then watch this. And he will wipe away every tear from their eye. There will no longer be any death. There will no longer be any mourning or crying or pain. Those first things, they passed away. And then when he sees all that, here's what happens. The one who sits on the throne, that's God, turns to John and says this, write this down. And he saw the vision. He says, write it down. For these words are faithful and they are true. This is where we're heading. And I know that sometimes when we're going through difficult times, this doesn't seem like enough. But if you take this out of the picture, none of this is going to ever make sense to you. God says, I'm taking you a place where I will wipe away every tear and all sorrow and mourning will be gone. Write this down. These words are true. Would you please pray with me?